I expect him to be found guilty of killing his wife. And I think after the autopsy tomorrow, people will have issues, I think, with the result of that as far as his involvement with the death of Elizabeth Ratlin.
Gave me chills. It was just incredible that that two of these could be so similar.
He looked at Kathleen Peterson and looked at Elizabeth Ratliff. They could pass for sisters.
Ms. Ratliff left Michael Peterson in charge of her children, as well as in charge of all of her personal property in the event that she died, which of course did happen.
Her death, it's not as a result of a fall down the stairs, and my conclusion and my opinion is that she was also beaten.
Lightning doesn't strike in the same place twice. It just simply doesn't happen.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Z. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
And we're right in the middle of shooting... my episode, 1409, and it's called Broken Wing, and we have an amazing cast. Thank you, Lisa.
Oh, you are so welcome. I can't wait. I can't wait to visit set, too, and see how it's all going with our director, Aisha Tyler.
Yeah, she's such a pleasure to work with. It's fantastic. Jumping back into our conversation about Liz Ratliff and her death at the bottom of a staircase 17 years before... Kathleen, Michael Peterson's wife, would die also at the bottom of a staircase. I don't like the coincidence of it, and I think there are too many different aspects of it that are eerily similar.
Yeah, the prosecutors agree with you. They think it's eerie too. But can I ask you guys, what kind of a dumb murderer would do the thing twice? I mean,
one who got away with it the first time.
And I've certainly seen that in cases. And I was going to talk about two different cases, actually. One where professionals said, exactly as we heard Frieda say and others, lightning doesn't strike twice. Well, I had a case where, in fact, the first part to it was dramatized in a show called You Be Dead. And it was a Dr. Jan Falkowski who was being stalked, and his new partner, his fiance, Debbie, who he was going to go on to marry, she was being targeted. Now, she became, although Jan was the primary target, Deborah was the one who was targeted more in terms of letters and things being sent about the stalker wanting to kill her, and said that if she went through with the marriage to Jan Falkowski, that she would be dead. And the person who was stalking her had all sorts of information and would, even if she went to the dentist, she would receive a text message about how white her teeth looked. Mm. So a very terrifying situation for Deborah. And also for Jan, he was almost struck off as a doctor because a rape allegation was made that he had raped somebody and he was being investigated for that rape. And the person had taken a condom out of his trash bag, out of the rubbish bag, and had put some semen in their knickers and had taken that to the police, claiming that it had been rape. So there were all sorts of twists and turns in this case. The short story is that the police did a really good job, and they set up this sort of pseudo wedding, and they lured the stalker to this fake wedding, and they arrested her. It turned out to be a female called Marchese, who's currently in a secure unit for threatening and attempting to kill Deborah and Jan. Now, the case ended up being referred back to me a number of years later. Now, this is, 8 to 10 years later, where the original victim, Deborah, calls me to say that it started all over again and that the same behaviours are happening. Mm. Now, I mean, this was just such a bizarre set of circumstances, text messages being sent, emails being sent, communication about where she was living, what was happening in her life. And it was so similar that, of course, I coordinated a meeting with the police. Was Marchese, had she gotten out, or was she in communication with someone? And we all round the table said, well, we don't believe lightning strikes twice. Now, you know, this case had all sorts of twists and turns, but where it landed was it ended up being that her new husband that she had married, because Jan and her didn't end up getting married due to all the stress and strain and everything else that went on previously, she married somebody else, and it turned out to be he was having an affair, and it was the woman he was having an affair with that was targeting Deborah, matching what Marchese did in exactly the same way to create maximum fear.
Wow.
So could you ever write that?
Oh, God.
I mean, you know, we were all flabbergasted. She was arrested. But the fact is, when I do hear people say lightning doesn't strike twice, I have had those cases where, you know, and you know this, Jim, the 1% happens of something that is outside what you've seen before. But then, you know, you can flip it. I've also had a case that I've reviewed, the murder of someone called Helen Bailey, who went missing. She was a young children's author, very successful, very gregarious, funny, eloquent, smart, witty. And you can see her talking on various blogs, because she had a tragedy in her life when her husband of 20 odd years died while she was on the beach. And she was stood on the beach watching him. I believe it was in Barbados. He got caught in a riptide and she couldn't do anything to help him. So she wrote this book, When Bad Things Happen in Good Bikini. She had this sense of humor that she tried to deal with her grief by putting it out there online, wrote this book and wrote these blogs. Now, she then started to go on these chat bereavement sort of online forums, and she met this man called Ian Stewart. And she had said to him, I don't want to be in a relationship. You know, I'm still going through everything. But he started turning up unannounced to her home address in London. You know, is that romantic, or is it someone pushing boundaries when she's saying, you know, I don't want this relationship? Well, it becomes this whirlwind relationship where he persuades her to move out of London, move into a village in Hertfordshire where she knew no one. And of course, you know what high risk factor falls out of that, of, you know, leaving your family, your friends, isolation, and she didn't have people around her. And her mother said that she was calling her up and saying things like, you know, I seem to be losing my mind. I keep falling asleep. I keep forgetting things. And so things were changing in her world. Now she'd moved in with Ian Stewart. He had persuaded her to change her will. I mean, she had, you know, in excess of 4 million from all the work she'd done, very successfully as a children's author. She did change her will because he was saying, you know, for power of attorney, you had your husband die unexpectedly. He said, my wife died unexpectedly and suddenly, so we should, you know, make arrangements just in case by some freak, you know, accident, something happens.
Mm.
And she agrees to that. So she changes her will, gives him power of attorney. And actually, even before they get married, because he was trying to marry her, although no wedding date was set, she went missing. And 3 days later, he reports her missing to the police. Anyway, there's lots of other aspects in between in terms of very peculiar behaviours of him, for example, going on the holiday that they had booked without her. Obviously,
oh, wow.
She was missing, but he still goes on holiday. So obviously for Jim, no doubt that would raise a question mark straight away.
No, even for me.
Necessarily for the,
that sounds weird.
For Lisa, maybe for some people it would. For others, well, maybe he needs some time out. But he had met with his son. He had a son from the previous marriage where he had said that his first wife had died from hitting her head outside. She had epilepsy. That his version of events, his narrative, was believed that that's what happened. So when Helen goes missing, that isn't even brought into the equation. And when he has dinner with his son, the night she goes missing, he doesn't even mention it. So he goes off on this holiday. The police turn up on his at his home address. It's early one morning. And you can actually watch this on, it's on a program called Murdered by My Fiancé. And you can see the footage of the police turning up, knocking on the door. He's wearing his dressing gown. And they say, you know, we want to talk to you in relation to Helen going missing. And he turns around. He says, oh, okay, that's fine. Hang on. I think I may have left the garage open. You're not going to check the garage, are you?
What?
At which point, yeah, this is an unconscious utterance. He was so surprised to see them. This is weeks later. So they decide to check the garage and they find a cesspit and they find Helen's body and her little dachshund dog, Boris.
Yeah.
His body was also found in the cesspit. Now, the point here is that he was charged with Helen's murder. Her body was found, I think it was in July, 3 months later, after she had been, you know, a missing person. His previous wife, Diane, had died suddenly and unexpectedly in 2010. This is 2016. And he's just been rearrested, I've just been told, for the murder of his first wife, Diane, in August 2018. He was arrested. So, you know, the question marks and or the things that people say and the narrative that they have, Ian Stewart was a very plausible individual. And, you know, he had many, not just officials, but people believing his version of events. And he targeted Helen Bailey. This case was all about coercive control. And, you know, although how they died was different, the motive and the reason, the motivation behind it and the coercive control on both, you know, are things that were missed by pretty much all professionals and family members until, you know, I looked at the case and could see, you know, you join up all the dots. And of course, it now looks very obvious when you talk to it in a narrative in that way, but it wasn't obvious at the time. So people sometimes, you know, when they do get away with it, as Jim says, they carry on doing what they've done and they can become more reckless. But he hopefully will go on trial for the murder of his first wife.
Well, Raleigh-Durham prosecutors definitely wanted to know what had happened to Liz Ratliff. And although she died in Germany, she was buried in Texas, right? And they had her sister agree to get her exhumed and to re-examine her body to see if indeed she did die from a cerebral hemorrhage or from natural causes, or if it could be sort of matched similarly to Kathleen's murder.
And whether it's overreaching on the part of the medical examiner or a lot of pressure from the prosecutor, I don't know. But eerily enough, the findings of this second autopsy were consistent with murder, not an accidental fall. And so that looked really bad for Michael Peterson. That really changed things for him.
But don't you think they should have, in all fairness, had her evaluated by a different medical examiner, you know, either in Texas or by somebody else in North Carolina? Because this was the same medical examiner who had examined Kathleen. And couldn't there be bias there? Or what do you think?
Well, that often happens in the UK. You would ask, you know, for the same pathologist, and you would want somebody to look at with, you know, very good knowledge of what they're looking for. I mean, the biggest challenge is this is 17 years later, you know, and that exhumation, the turmoil and the upset and distress for Margaret and Martha, yeah. You know, and there's another point there is that they reluctantly agreed to it.
Yeah.
So they were horrified and distressed, but they've, you know, and I think the point here is that it's the search for the truth. That's the most important thing. And that's why the body was traveled, you know, 1,250 miles, 18 hours driving time, but to get to the truth, because that autopsy wasn't sufficient the first time round. I don't know what you think, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Unless there was some kind of claim that this medical examiner was not doing a proper autopsy, not stating the facts as they were discovered, and somehow was overly influenced by the prosecution. Without that, it would be the illogical choice, because they're looking for particular things that may have been missed last time. And so the fact that she had experience already doing an autopsy from that particular set of circumstances, a woman found dead at the bottom of the stairs, I think that's a very normal, logical choice. She was the chief medical examiner, right?
I think she went on to become the chief.
But I guess that's my point, not to throw shade on the doctor at all, but she knows what she's looking for, you know, I think it would have been better to have somebody completely objective who could say, yes, this was a homicide. And I think that would have been even stronger evidence. I mean, that's just the way I look at it.
But that's saying that you think she's conflicted out. Why would she be conflicted? She's just there to state the facts of what she determines.
But I'm just saying that
why would there be a bias?
Well, because people have unconscious biases all the time, and she already knows what she's looking for. She already, I mean, we saw this in The Deaver, and we'll get to that guy. But, you know, he was trying to reverse engineer the evidence in some ways and make things fit. I'm not saying that she did that deliberately, but, you know, I mean, scientists make mistakes
too. Well, hang on. I think we should just make sure that we understand that Duane Deaver is an entirely different kettle of fish.
Good, yeah.
And I don't think you can draw a comparison of like on like. You know, most scientists are there to look at the science and to be completely objective in the presentation of what they find. It's not looking to find something to fit a narrative. Otherwise, every professional, you know, you would argue would be conflicted out. She is there to determine what she can from what's left of, you know, sadly, Liz's body 17 years later. And Duane Deaver is a very different character. And that's why he was struck out of the SBI.
There's enough similarities between the two deaths that they've had Ratliff's body exhumed from a cemetery here in Texas and brought to the medical examiner's office in Chapel Hill.
Ratliff's body will be guarded the entire time it heads back to Chapel Hill. That vehicle will be followed by Durham investigators, and even when they spend the night in Alabama tonight, there will be guards looking over the body.
If you think about it this way, the FBI lab is the largest lab in the country, maybe even in the world, the largest forensic lab. And everyone who works there is an FBI employee. And if you were to try to say that they were conflicted out because they did two analyses on the same case, I mean, it would shut down the operation of the FBI lab. And it's just, that's not how it's done in this country. Yeah, sure. In a documentary, you can poke holes in things and say people might have been influenced or biased. But the fact is, as Laura said, these are scientists and they're supposed to stay within the law and their scientific backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And they're not supposed to be looking for a particular outcome. When you do, you get people like Deaver and you get false testimony. Really? And, you know, that guy should have been thrown in jail. There's no question about it. But it sounds like it's a good segue into that conversation.
And just to go back, you know, with comparative case analysis, for example, a lot of the work that I've done in law enforcement, you're looking at cases and comparing them. And we'd run major investigations and we would ask, you know, whether it was a Metropolitan Police Service or the London District and other police forces to look for certain characteristics of crimes and to send them to me or whoever was the lead analyst. And we would do comparative case analysis and similar fact on cases because we knew what we were looking for. But that doesn't mean to say that we were conflicted out. You would say what was present that was similar, but you would also say what was absent. And you have to retain that level of professionalism in what you do. And I certainly saw no indication that there were any questions or question marks about Dr. Radish's capability or competence level or her judgment.
Yeah, Jim pointed it out in an earlier episode that he doesn't understand why she did she marked certain things. I'm not saying that she doesn't know what she's doing or she was complicit at all, but we have pointed out that there were things in her autopsy report that Jim has said in an earlier episode he didn't understand why that was.
But that can always be the case with any professional. Jim and I, looking at any case, we can find, this is interesting. What do you think about this? Well, we'd need to ask them about why X or Y Z. You know, that's the whole point. You have reviewing professionals as well. But that doesn't mean to say that they are not good at their job. It just means to say that there are other questions that you would ask. But we have had cases where the same pathologist would look at, you know, the blunt force trauma on the head. You know, in Operation Yedis, we kept the same pathologist so that we wanted to understand what was similar, what was different. Is it the same weapon? Is it not? That's not abnormal. by any stretch of the imagination. I think the exhumation in itself is the what some people might find is the anomaly. You know, why 17 years later and put the family back through all of that, you know, heartache and upset and the distress of doing it? I think people bumped on.
Well, I think we could agree that we would prefer to have, well, I would have preferred to have Dr. Spitz or Dr. Lee look at that body and that tissue and the actual instead of photographs and whatnot that they had to work with Kathleen and get their, you know, get what they had to say. I would have trusted their word.
You would have wanted the number one guys in their fields to do it, but they certainly can't do every case. And just because this was the subject of a docuseries doesn't mean that they're going to get involved in it. However, sometimes when, you know, I mean, Dr. Lee is not a forensic pathologist. Sure. He's a criminalist.
Sure.
And so he's got a lot of general, you know, experience and expertise, but he's not a medical examiner. So Dr. Spitz is, and I don't know for sure, you know, if they even tried to get him or what he would have said if they did get him. But unfortunately, we don't have the benefit of their expertise in these cases.
Right.
One thing it might just be worth pointing out is that Aphrodite Jones did interview Michael Peterson and asked about what happened in Germany. And I just want to give you the benefit of what he said, because his answer was, "You mean what happened the night Liz Ratliff died?" And he said, "Okay, at no time ever, ever, ever was there any question or talk or suspicion of there being anything other than this being anything other than a natural death. The German police didn't see anything. The American police didn't see anything. The doctor didn't see anything. Why didn't somebody say something at the time? Like, this is a suspicious death. Yet nobody ever, ever raised this until Kathleen died."
Yeah, well, and that's when they should raise it. And the fact that he's completely overselling this is a big red flag.
Right.
Ever, ever, ever. Well, his narrative was there right from the start. And I still say, even in The Staircase, his narrative continues with very little context, really, not just to Kathleen, but to Liz as well. We don't learn a whole amount about her, do we? We don't get an understanding of her life and how she lived and who she was. And we really don't hear too much about, you know, the death. There are some conflicting accounts that we do hear about in terms of the blood, which I thought, you know, was interesting. Was there blood or was there not? You know, the fact she, well, firstly, she was apparently wearing boots. Now, those who knew her said that she didn't wear boots in the house. She was one of these people who always wanted to take shoes off, you know, when being in the house, and would make other people take their shoes off. But she was actually wearing boots. Now, whether that's relevant, was she running from something? Had she come in? Or, you know, why did she have the boots on? There's questions asked. But the blood, I think we heard from Amy and from Barbara and others who gave accounts. Some said that there was a lot of blood, and others said that they didn't recall any blood. But I think it was Amy and Barbara who said that there was blood at the top of the stairs. There was some spatter at the top of the stairs. And that Amy, when she went into the house, was worried that it was a murder right from the start, and felt very uncomfortable that there was something more, you know, and that maybe she had been murdered and she was pregnant at the time and had had a number of miscarriages, apparently, and her husband had told her not to involve herself with the police and that they would process the crime scene and to leave it to the police to investigate what had happened. You know, thoughts on her being found wearing boots and the question about blood. What were your thoughts about that, Jim or Lisa?
Well, I think the question of blood, people do edit out things that are disturbing to them. And some people don't like to look at a dead body. And so they might have been averting their eyes and not seeing. Plus, she was on the second step or third step. So she was elevated. The blood may have been pooled underneath the stairwell, and they may have had to sort of walk around at a different angle to actually see it. There's all sorts of different explanations for that. But as we know, the worst possible evidence that you could put in a trial is eyewitness testimony. And it's because people do edit what they see and experience. and they do not necessarily record everything. And when you have a great passage of time, people's memories can be incredibly faulty and not to be relied on.
Right. And I guess, you know, we have to bear in mind that her body was moved at least twice. And they did clean things up in the house quite quickly. So, you know, who saw what at which time? And with the time and distance, as you say, it's not very reliable in terms of the accounts that we've heard from.
Right. And I think what you have to do is really nail down a timeline of those statements and then find out who was doing cleaning. And, you know, it's also very possible that there was cleaning done before the body was found.
Well, and I just watched the scene where Patty is sitting in the same room and looking at the stairs and describing things. It's hard for me to think that she's lying. But like you say, maybe she just didn't see it, you know, she from her angle, or she just didn't want to see it. Or like when we talked with Dr. Austin about people who say, oh, this is a big rainstorm. It's not a big rainstorm. Like what people think of as a lot of blood or not a lot of blood, I guess, can vary. Or but just having just watched.
I mean, how many of these people ever attended a crime scene before, ever saw a bloody crime scene? I don't think that Patty was lying. I mean, it's just, this is the problem. You can't take someone's statement and parse it out piece by piece and say, this is exactly what this person meant, and this is exactly what this person experienced. It's a very, very amorphous thing. When people say things, they mean different things by using the same words. And it's unfortunate, but that's what we're stuck with. All these years later, it's a lot more difficult to figure out what actually happened because time has passed. And these people are not forensically trained, and they're not experts in these fields that they are now opining in, how much blood and what could have caused it and what could have caused the fall and so on and so forth.
As Laura says, there were no pictures of this death, which is so incredible to me. At least if we had that, you know, you could really kind of dig in to see where the truth lies, but nope.
But that's the problem when it's treated as non-suspicious mm-hmm. right from the start. Right. So when you've got a dominant male saying this is what happened and he seems to be plausible and he's owning the narrative and then the officials aren't asking questions, it looks like the obvious thing. And therefore it's written up as the obvious thing. And there's an autopsy without someone asking those questions. I mean, it is certainly a very bizarre situation, you know, 17 years prior and very tragic situation that Liz is found and 2 years before her husband died. And of course, we've still got these little girls, Martha and Margaret, who lost their father, then lost their mother. And I believe it was Barbara, the nanny, who stayed trying to look after them for a little while. And Michael Peterson was injecting himself and going round there all the time, seeing the little girls. But Barbara's account also in Diane Fanning's book, she talked to the fact that she thought Michael Peterson was mean to them, and especially Martha. And she gave an account that one time Martha urinated on the carpet, you know, sometimes little children do. She wet herself, and he apparently rubbed her face in it.
Oh, geez.
What? Oh!
Mm. These accounts really do concern me in terms of Michael Peterson's behavior, and that he wanted to take the girls back to the US, but he apparently wanted to give Martha up. He didn't want to keep her because he said that she was manipulative when she was 3 years old. I mean...
Wow.
Yeah, very concerning. And of course, you know, these little girls who've lost everything that they knew and their whole world changed and then they moved to America, I'm not surprised that there would have been behaviors that, you know, them acting out. But it's his lack of tolerance in terms of dealing with them. And apparently there was a lot of back and forth of him saying that he was going to give the girls up and he was going to give them to their Auntie Margaret. And then he said that he'd give them to Anne, his sister. And so there was this constant, is he going to give them up? Is he not? But he never adopted them. And then when he and Patty split up, he said again that they would go to their Auntie Margaret. But again, he changed his mind at the last minute. So it wasn't this kind of seamless, how great is Michael Peterson taking these two little girls and adopting them? There was a number of times where he talked about giving them up, you know, as if they're kind of property or possessions and hand them over to people. But of course, he is the one constant thing that they know. And I still feel that that relationship, they're treading on eggshells. And maybe that's the legacy of that relationship, that particularly with Martha, that, you know, he had this explosive temper at times. And that account is correct. I have no reason not to believe what Barbara was saying, rubbing a three-year-old's face on the carpet when they wet themselves.
It's like a dog.
It's very concerning.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
It is.
They were married for a very short period of time. They've been laying together here side by side for 17 years. And now they're going to move her out. I know that captain would raise hell. This is crazy.
Before we move on, you know, Rudolph has this research group or this, I don't know what you guys call it, but where that he talks about them to Germany, like a practice jury, and says and tries to get their opinion on what they think happened in Germany. Have you ever seen that done before? What do you call it? It's not a research,
a focus group.
Yes,
sure.
is that normal? Yeah. I mean, you must have very big pockets to be able to do that if you're, you know, a defendant. That not just anybody can have a pretend jury and get these kind of results so that you can craft your defense, right?
Yeah, that's something that costs money, and wealthy people get to do it. And other people who are just, you know, normal people or poor people don't get the same kind of defense. And that's what is so inequitable about our system. The more money you have, the more likelihood you have of getting acquitted in a criminal trial.
Yeah. But it's interesting because they ask these potential jurors, you know, what they know about the case and Germany. Before David Rudolph and Ron go to Germany and interview. And then they give them the evidence and then ask what they think afterwards. And it's interesting that the jury does believe Michael Peterson more. The more they know about, you know, the circumstances of Liz's death, the more they believe that it was a coincidence. I thought that was really interesting.
This is a jury that they hired, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, some people want to give you what you want to hear.
Although one of them said, you know, that he thought that taking custody of the girls was a good motive for murder. So he didn't believe that it was sort of a very honorable thing that Michael took the girls' custody. It was like that he wanted those girls and he got rid of the mother so he could have them. So I thought that was interesting.
We have no idea what evidence, quote, they showed them or how they manipulated them. It's just a total open question. It's just talk about a room for bias. There you go. Well, the next topic we want to cover is the, quote, blood spatter expert, Mr. Deaver. Unfortunately, in the interim between the first iteration of this docuseries and the second one, it was determined that Mr. Deaver actually lied on the stand, lied about his credentials, lied about his experience, and lied about the results of his, quote, tests or experiments, lied about the nature of them. And that, in my mind, completely undermines the prosecution's case. It is unfortunate, but the ripple effect of something like that, of calling a witness who is supposedly a respected professional in the field and having that person's testimony be so damning for the defendant, it's no wonder at all that he gets a new trial.
Yes, very concerning, the so-called blood spatter expert. And of course, the Greg Taylor case came to light February 2010. I mean, just absolutely horrific, being in prison for, what was it, 16 years, having been found guilty for a brutal murder of a 26-year-old in 1981. And Greg had put himself forward to the police because he had been smoking crack cocaine in a car, his car, near where her body had found, but he'd left the car but let the police know that he may have seen her body. And then he is arrested. And there's thought to be blood in his SUV. However, it turned out that it wasn't blood when it was retested, and those results were not revealed to the jury. And apparently it was the same Dwayne Deaver, who was the person involved in that case, who didn't disclose, failed to disclose it wasn't blood. So these alarming cases that had such a serious repercussion on other people's lives obviously opened the door. It was wide open for David Rudolph to call all his cases into question and quite rightly so, question his credentials.
So we should say that this is after Michael Peterson has been found guilty, and then, you know, all of this comes out about the blood specialist, and he had a great impact on the initial jury. Apparently they really took what he said to heart and all his experiments, and that, you know, that really proved to them that Michael could have indeed, you know, done this to Kathleen. And I cannot tell you how much I hate this guy, because he does so much damage to the justice system in general, because all of his bullshit provides so much grist for the conspiracy mill against scientists. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, how hard it is for scientists, and they have to have such a high bar for their work. And here's a guy who's just basically taking a huge dump on the whole process, and he calls into question all these other scientists. I mean, you know what I mean by the damage he does to juries who are even,
of course,
at people. It just absolutely makes my blood boil.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. And even if the prosecution had made mistakes, and, you know, their theory of the case and the blowpoke was wrong, you know, that doesn't mean that the person is innocent.
Yeah.
However, because of what Deaver did, it completely undermines the prosecution's case. It completely undermines everything he did in all of his cases. So all of these other cases could be completely destroyed because he didn't have the integrity that scientific experts are supposed to have.
Yeah, and it completely undermines Frieda and Hardin and all those people, because she says in front of the jury, "What are, you know, do we think that, you know, Dr. Deaver is lying? You know, is he in cahoots with us?" Or, I mean, he undermines their entire office, you know, going forward. It's just, it just makes
absolutely
me crazy.
And in that role, you certainly have to be unbiased. I mean, in all these roles, it's not having an agenda, it's presenting the facts. And he appeared to invest in, you know, in other cases, in the prosecution's case, without the evidence. And of course, he's fired. That's in 2010, but he's fired from the SBI in 2011. I mean, he'd also inflated his credentials. And I believe his lawyers actually tried to argue that he was the scapegoat. However, you know, there were shortcomings in 34 cases that he had worked on. And of course, when you've got people like Greg Taylor spending 16 years in prison, you know, when there, nothing put him at that scene, nothing in terms of witnesses or any form of forensic evidence tied him to the victim. And yet it's convenient to do so, according to Dwayne Deaver. I mean, it just terrifying. In terms of his impact. But there were, I mean, just to say, there were other experts that were called in to review the case. I think Jim Hardin talked to three other experts that he called in. And in that particular case, the staircase, of course, they were talking about, you know, a retrial, etc. But the other experts apparently would have said similarly to Deaver. They came up with similar conclusions. And I think that was Herve McDonald, Bart Epstein, and Terry Laborer, who are all, you know, renowned experts in the field of blood spatter. So, you know, that having been said, that would have been interesting to see what, if, you know, those independent reports would have shown.
Right.
But of course, it did have a profound impact on this case.
Right. But as we said, when we looked at his, quote, experiments and his tests, I mean, they were just bullshit. I mean, there's
they
no
teenagers.
Other way to say it. They were like
teenage tests.
Yes, they're just ridiculous. For example, when he's using the blowpoke and he's hitting like basically a sponge on a piece of wood, he breaks the blowpoke. He breaks it, and he's not even hitting it hard. There's just no way that that's gonna create the kind of
lacerations that you see, you know, in this case. And then, you know, he's dropping things and he's trying to splatter things and they're jumping up and down and high-fiving and getting all excited. I mean, it's just the scientific method. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, it's so bad. So, you know, that should have, I mean, unfortunately, the defense was inadequate in terms of, like, actually drilling down and finding out what this guy's credentials really were or questioning his methodologies. It would have been a lot better if that had happened right in the first trial.
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean, there was another 2009 case that was talked about as well, where he did this experiment where he asked one of his colleagues to basically put some blood on the edge of a knife and to run it across a shirt to kind of simulate what was seen and mirror what was seen on the potential perpetrator's shirt. And he directed the person whilst filming. And, you know, it became quite legendary that he basically then does it the first time, says he's not happy. Then he does it another time again. And he says, holy cow, that's a good one. That's a rat, baby.
Right.
And I think we see that on the staircase, yep. Don't we? And apparently that was used to show how not to do things, you know, for a long time, and how you can be so biased and conflicted trying to fit and recreate things and fit it to the prosecution's case. And I think in that case, the individual was acquitted. But I mean, to me, it wasn't just, you know, teenager kind of like science experiments. It was even less than that. And how that could be seen as anything other than for what it was. I mean, David Rudolph does pass comment on it and said, every time I showed him a textbook and asked him, you know, for his theory or his thoughts, he'd say, oh, but that's wrong. That's wrong. You know, but I'm surprised that Rudolph didn't kind of open that up prior to 2010 as an issue, because to have, you know, Diva, and I think there were parts where it just seemed very peculiar just to say all the other experts are wrong and he's right.
Yeah. Well, he did have,
it seemed to be an arrogance about him for
God,
sure.
Oh God, my casting instincts just had a field day on who I would cast to play this guy. I was like, oh, anyway. Yeah. But he is not, I have a lot of anger for one other person in this documentary that I will tell you about when we wrap this up. But Deaver's a close second. Anyway.
I think I know who the other one might
do
be.
You?
Lisa. Does it have an impact on the potential editing, a question of
yes,
editing?
Yes, but it's not who you think. I bet it's not who you think, but I'm going to rip this person. Never mind. We'll get there when we get there. But anyway.
So we still have a lot more to talk about, and we're going to return and carry on talking about the staircase. But I have I have one recommendation that I'd like to make for our listeners. I already mentioned the Helen Bailey case, which is a potentially similar case. And there was a documentary called Murdered by My Fiancé, which aired February 23rd, 2017 on Channel 5. And I'm on it talking about the behaviors. So I would recommend you have a look at that and you'll get a different sort of context and understanding of coercive control. And how about you, Jim? Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I'm in the middle of this current season of Ozark and I'm really loving it. I am constantly fascinated by the twists and the turns and how they get out of them and all the different craziness that happens. It's just really well written. I have to really give a shout out to my friend Chris Mundy, who runs the show. Yeah. And I just think it's just a fascinating, it's sort of a microcosm of the world. You know, it's a tiny little town, but there's so much going on there that I think it's a fascinating series.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to an actor who's on there, Jim, the actor with the red hair and the beard. His name is Mark Menchaca, and I've been trying to get him on Criminal Minds for a really long time, and I'm determined to do it by the end of this season. So, Mark, get ready. You're going to be on Criminal Minds. I want to do a quick rec to a very silly show, but I know our listeners will love, called The Good Cop. It stars Tony Danza and Josh Groban. And it is a very...
Oh, I started watching that too.
It is so silly, but good. Yeah. And it's like, you know, we watch a lot of dark things. You know, we all are drawn to watching dark things. And this is, I think, it's a procedural, but it's got a light heart to it. And Tony Danza is adorable. And Josh Groban plays his son. So I recommend that on Netflix.
Yeah, there's a nice light touch to it. And I've got to say, when I was in London and traveling to Vauxhall, Killing Eve was everywhere. So I got into Killing Eve, and Sandra Oh is superb in it. I mean, dark and twisty. Yeah, loved it. So definitely look out for that. So we've got so much more to talk about. Talking of twists and turns, The Staircase has taken us on so many, and Kathleen Peterson and Liz Ratliff. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.